The objective of the Torah is to transmit the basic truths to man. The truth about God, the creation, the nature of the reality in which he finds himself. That's basically what each person, I imagine, is searching for. Well, I don't know, something else. Not everybody's really searching for anything. But those who ponder, who think about it, want to understand the reality that you find yourself in. The world. What's the world? And your own nature, your own makeup. So basically, that's the Torah. That the objective is for man to obtain knowledge and understanding in order to achieve the objective. However, it's not just a system of abstract ideas. You do see a certain development in Judaism, because the fathers, the avos, the imos, the matriarchs, the patriarchs, the ones who founded the system, which is a very interesting idea, and I'm not sure you'll find this in other religions, that those who are the founders and the ultimate role models are not depicted as really following the religion that we follow. You'd expect that these people would be depicted as keeping the commandments and doing the mitzvahs and observing the rituals. They're never, ever. I made the point yesterday that you don't find in general in Tanakh, when it goes into the lives of these significant people, you don't find any description of them observing halacha or doing mitzvahs. It never talks about David, and then he went to pray, to put on his tefillin, or Shabbos was coming and they were preparing the table. You never have that kind of stuff. It never mentions it at all. However, we know that they kept it from the Torah Shebaal Peh. I was making this a significant point. You could read the entire Tanakh and walk away with the impression, if your only source was Tanakh, and you didn't accept any other source, you would say these people didn't keep any, the religion you're keeping, they didn't keep religion at all. Because it's not even mentioned over there. How can anybody write a biography? Would you conceive of that today, to write a biography about somebody, especially a religious figure, and you would read that book and you'd have no idea that this person kept a religion? That's an absurdity. To the contrary, all of the biographies today about the great sages focus on their piety. But piety, as expressed in the doing of the mitzvos, and they like to emphasize that kind of thing, how they were so careful in every area when it came to lulav or sukkah. That's the focus of most of the biographies today. However, if you go back to the Torah, Tanakh, you don't find that at all. There's no emphasis at all. We're trying to build them up and portray their greatness with regard to their halachic meticulousness, which is a big feature of today's biographies. When you go back to the Avos, it's not just that it's not mentioned. All right, there's a question. We have the concept of the seven Noahide laws. And we do find that they prayed. We do find certain mitzvos, circumcision, a few mitzvos that they performed. But the Torah as a whole, the system that we keep, there are statements of some that they did keep the commandments, which is a difficult concept, because they knew the commandments through prophecy. That's very, very difficult. The Rambam does not learn that way. The Rambam says that God added mitzvos, kept adding mitzvos, and above and beyond the seven, until the Torah was completed at Sinai. But it wasn't that they had that many mitzvos. So he doesn't say that they knew all the mitzvos through prophecy. It's a very difficult concept, because so many of the mitzvos are contingent upon the remembering the Exodus. All the holidays have to do with the Exodus. So it's very difficult that they celebrated, that the Elohim celebrated these things prior to it happening. Not to mention all the mitzvot that are contingent upon the land, which don't come into effect until they conquer the land. So, what do you see from that? Let's operate now with the idea that the Avos, as the Rambam depicts it, that did not keep the Tarryag mitzvot. They only kept seven plus, a few more, not that many more. Tangentially, in a sense, In today's world, Judaism always extols the convert, even though the Jewish people do not always live up to the ideals of Judaism. The Jewish people do not always live up to the ideals of Judaism. We mentioned this over Shavuos when we studied the idea that you can't appoint a ger, a convert, cannot be appointed to be the king, or to any other position of responsibility in Judaism. And we discussed that at length. Is that a case of second-class citizenship? That we're saying that Jews are inherently superior, and therefore, even though we let you join the club, but you're, so to speak, a second-class citizen? The answer is that it's not the case. And the ger, in many respects, the convert, is on a higher level than someone who was born Jewish. And if he keeps the Torah, if he studies Torah, if he becomes a Talmud Chacham, so he's the Torah authority. However, he can't be appointed officially. And the reason is because even though he's not to be regarded as inferior, even though we don't maintain that the Jews are intrinsically superior at all, to the contrary, this person is superior because he became Jewish out of choice. Nevertheless, the fact of the matter is that there is such a reality among Jewish people. That the Jewish people, is it true that the Jewish people accord the ger the full respect, or is there a certain attitude of aloofness when it comes to, officially, no. Officially, he's a convert, he's wonderful. But would you bring him into your home? Can he marry your children, or can she marry your children? Is there a certain sense of superiority? That is the point, that the Jewish people may not be on that ideal. So there's always a danger. There's a danger that if you appoint someone who is a convert, so the people will not accord him the full respect. That there's a base emotion. Who are you to tell me what to do? There is such a feeling. There's no question about it. There's a very moving story, a very poignant story I told the people on Rosh Hashanah. I read it. The Rav brings it down. It's brought down in some of the Noros HaRav, which this person wrote up the shiurim that the Rav gave on the holidays and Rosh Hashanah and so on and so forth. So in one of them, he tells the story. It's connected to the tefillah we say, where Asha ani rishon, vani achron, umibal dayen elokim. That's one of the psukim that's brought down in Malchios, Achronos, and Shofros. Ani Hashem, ani rishon. God says, ani rishon, I am the first, vani achron, I am the last. Umibal adai, and besides me, ain elokim, there's no other God. So he told the story in conjunction with that pasuk. This is a story that takes place at the time of the Vilna Gaon. And the Rav says he can vouch for the truthfulness because it was passed down in his family. And there was this individual, I don't have the name now, who was the son of one of the wealthiest people, a Gentile obviously, one of the wealthiest people in Poland. Exceedingly wealthy individual. And he had a son who was extremely bright. And they sent him off to, I guess, in Italy, one of the colleges there. And that was like the Harvard of its time. And when the son was there, he met Jewish students. You know, a collegiate atmosphere, even in those days when there was persecution and hatred in the 70s, but even, I guess, on a collegiate atmosphere, there was more of a certain liberalness, a certain openness. And the son was very, very brilliant. And he began to learn about Judaism, and he studied Judaism, and he converted to Judaism. So you have to understand that in those days, in Poland, the law in Poland was that if a Catholic converted, I would imagine to any religion, but certainly to Judaism, he was liable to the death penalty. So he couldn't go back. So he went for a while, he went to a different country. I don't remember now which country. It's mentioned in the story. But the Rav, in telling the story over, says he got very lonely. He didn't know anybody over there. He was in a strange country. But he couldn't come back. He was afraid to come back. So he says he would have been better off if he had stayed there, by way of letting you know what's happening. Anyways, he decided to come back to Poland, and he's living in a small town in Poland. But he has to be incognito. So now he's living in a Jewish community, and what did he do? He sat and learned all day. He was a real Ger Tzedek. He was a real righteous individual. And he was sitting and learning all day in the Beis Medrash. One way or another, word got out among the Jews that he was a convert and so on. They knew. Jews have a way of finding out these things. So they sort of knew who he was and that he had converted. So one day, there were some kids in the Beis Medrash, and they were making noise. So he told them to, you know, be quiet, or please, whatever it was. He told them to be quiet. So the kids ran, and one of them told the father. And the father was, I'm not sure which trade. So the father got very upset, you know, got very insulted. And he berated him. He says, who are you? You're a guy. Who are you, a guy, to tell my son to be quiet? That's what he called. So this person was so upset and so enraged that he went and he snitched. He went to the authorities and he squealed.
I think you did tell me stories, but I remember.
So the word got out that this son of this famous Polish aristocrat and the authorities arrested him for this crime. And his parents, of course, were notified. And the parents came to the son, and because of their influence, they worked it out that if he would renounce Judaism, everything would be okay. That he would be saved, and plus they'd restore him and give him back his position and his money. He'd have a great life. All he had to do was renounce Judaism. But he refused to do so. So he was a real, that's a great individual. He wouldn't do so, so they went ahead and they had the trial, and he was sentenced to death. So the Vilna Gaon was a young man at the time, and the time for the execution was on the night of Shavuos. And that night, the night before he was going to be executed, which was the night of Shavuos, the Vilna Gaon didn't go home to eat. Instead, he went to the prison to visit this young man. And he saw that he was very agitated and very, very upset. So the Vilna Gaon, I guess he was trying to comfort him. So he asked, why are you upset? Is it because you're afraid that they're going to torture you before they kill you? So he said, no. And he said that he's all alone and he doesn't have anybody. The way it's brought down in the story is that, he won't have his parents to be reunited in Olam Haba, something like that. Which may sound a little bit strange. But whatever the case is, that it doesn't really make any difference, the exact fact. But that troubled him, that he was alone. He didn't have anybody. So the Rav said that the Vilna Gaon then expounded on this pasuk, that Hashem says, Ani Rishon, Vani Acharon. That, what does it mean, Ani Rishon? It means Ani Rishon Lemisha Ein Lo'av, for someone who doesn't have a father. I am his father. And what does it mean, Vani Acharon? It's Lemisha Ein Lo Ben. It's for someone that doesn't have a son. And he expounded on that idea. I guess the basic point being is that after all is said and done, his connection to Hashem is what counts. And that supersedes everything else. So he said to the Vilna Gaon, that you've comforted me. And he departed, and that was it. And that, I think the Rav adds that that they're in a certain place, you know, where that snitcher, the squealer, lived. They used to refer to that house as the Moser. The house of the Moser. Moser is one of the worst of eros, to be a Moser, to give over. The Rambam brings that down. A Moser is someone who has no share in the world to come. That's someone who snitches on a Jew, not just in a case where the Jew dies, just the phenomenon of being a Moser, of causing another Jew to fall into the hands of the enemy, is a traitor, I guess. So, that's the story. There's a number of points, obviously, that we shouldn't overestimate ourselves. A person should be very, very cognizant of the nature of the emotions. But you do see from this that does reflect an attitude. Who are you to tell me what to do? That's a perfect illustration of that idea. And that's on a simple level. All he was doing was complaining that somebody was making noise. But the idea, the criticism, you're rebuking me, or you're saying that my son can't talk. Who are you? It's sort of a chutzpah dicker thing. Who are you? You're not even Jewish. Of course he's Jewish. So that, I think, is the underlying reason why he can't be appointed a king. Because the attitude of the Jewish people is not necessarily going to be on the level of the ideal. So when you set up a political system, it has to be based upon realistic kind of thinking. That's a good point. There's no question about it. But the way of the Torah, it's not going to jeopardize the kingship just so that people should work on an emotion. People should work on the emotion. That's part of perfection. So there's a certain ambivalence. You do see that phenomenon, though, that the Torah is based on a certain recognition of the reality. That's part of the reality, that people are not perfect. They're not perfect on day one. That's the whole goal. Look at the Torah. The Jewish people have been around for a long time. We're still in exile. So whatever it is that we've done wrong, we haven't corrected. And when you're establishing certain political situations, you know, it's not that important. The Torah didn't see fit to jeopardize the political situation just so that people will be forced to overcome an emotion. In the world of the Torah authorities, and they should be the real examples, you don't see that discrimination. Because some of the greatest rabbis were converts. The idea that David HaMelech descends from Rus, and the Onkelos was a convert, not to mention how many other converts were renowned Torah scholars. So in the world of truth, among that circle, you don't find any discrimination at all. Now the Rambam in chapter 9 of Hilchos Malachim. Al Shisha Dvarim Stava Adam Harishon. Adam Harishon was commanded on six things. Interesting, the Rambam doesn't say he was given six mitzvahs. It's Dvarim, it's like the Aseres HaDvarim. Dvarim doesn't mean Ten Commandments. We translate the Ten Commandments. A davar is ten utterances. It's ten ideas. It's more than just a commandment, because each commandment contains many mitzvahs. You break it down into specific mitzvahs. On six matters was Adam Harishon command. Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is a big area. There's many, many laws connected to Avodah Zarah. You can't just say it's one mitzvah. It's a super mitzvah. V'al Birkas Hashem. Blasphemy, commonly translated as blasphemy. V'al shvichas damim, murder. V'al giloi arayas, the forbidden sexual relations. V'al hagezel, on theft. V'al hadinin. Now the Rambam counts that as one of the seven. In this case, only six at this point. That is to say that they're obligated to set up a system of courts to enforce the laws, dinin, laws. They can't live in a state of hefker, so to speak. Then he mentions that the seventh was added. Everybody knows what the seventh, to Noach, the seventh, rounding out the seven Noachide laws. Eiver min achai, not to eat a limb from an animal until the animal has been killed. So that we understand why it wasn't given to Adam, because he was not really permitted to eat meat. He wasn't permitted to eat meat. So there was no concept of Eiver min achai. But once God gave man permission to eat meat, so then that becomes a whole new area of perfection, how to relate to animals, not to inflict pain on animals, and so on and so forth. So this, because that's a significant idea of the Torah, Tzar Bali Chaim, that it's prohibited to inflict pain on animals. And thus, Eiver min achai comes into the picture, so you have seven. Questions being raised that if the reason that Adam wasn't given Eiver min achai, limb of a living animal, is because he simply had no permission to eat meat, so therefore the law would have not been relevant. So what about some of the other laws? Setting up a court system, but he was the only one in the world at one point in time. or the forbidden sexual relations, and so on and so forth, does that not presuppose a society? And since he did not have a society, so then was it not a situation where the laws weren't relevant? How is that different than saying that Avram and Achai wouldn't have been relevant? Well, the question could have been asked, okay, it's true that he wasn't given permission to eat animals, but he still could have been subject to the prohibition of Avram and Achai, and that is to say that let's say he violated it. Let's say he violated it and he ate an animal. Or one can go, so there's a difference. There still would be a difference. Let's say he slaughtered an animal properly and did not violate Avram and Achai. Okay? So, okay, maybe it was wrong to eat the meat, but he didn't violate Avram and Achai. He did not violate Avram and Achai. But again, you could ask the question, what does it mean that he wasn't given permission to eat meat? Does that mean that he wasn't given permission to eat meat at all? Or does it mean he wasn't given permission to kill animals for the sake of meat? For example, let's say an animal died naturally. Was he then permitted to eat the meat? As far as the first part of the question, it seems that it's true when the laws were given to him initially, on minute one, you're right, there'd be no point in setting up a system of laws because he was the only person. Then Chava was created. I don't know how many people you have to have, but the point is he did live for 970 years. So the world was populated. So he was given the laws, and obviously when the situation arises, for them to be implemented, they're implemented. So theft, the forbidden sexual relations, once the time comes when they're applicable. After 500 years, there were many people, there were married people, he couldn't commit adultery, and so on. And the same would be true with enforcement, with theft, and so on and so forth.
And why would Moshe then later...
When God gives Noach permission to eat meat after the flood, it's not necessarily saying that he couldn't eat meat before. Mm-hmm. That he could have eaten meat before. But that was only when the animal died, which makes sense. Once the animal dies, so what's the problem? Why can't he eat the meat? If we assume that Adam HaRishon had permission to eat meat, provided that it died, then the question would arise, why was he not commanded on Avram and Achai? According to this, when God gives him permission to eat meat after the flood, it would seem that the permission was to kill animals for their meat, as opposed to...
Doesn't God dress them in food?
Continuing now in the Rambam. V'chein hoya hadomu b'chol ha'olam ad Avraham. And this was the way the matter stood in the entire world until Avraham. Nitztava yeser al elu b'mila. Avraham was given an additional command in circumcision. V'hu hispal shachris. And he daven shachris. That's the morning prayer. That's interesting. Notice the specifics of the language. That is, that God commanded him in circumcision. That was a direct command of Hashem. That was a mitzvah. But Avram daven shachris. Seems like he wasn't commanded to daven shachris. But nevertheless, the Rambam lists it. Then he says, V'yitzchak hifrish meiser. That Yitzchak separated meiser, the tithe. V'hosif tfila acheres lifnos hayom. And he added another prayer towards evening. As the day was, that's the day afternoon prayer, afternoon. V'yakev hosif giranasha. Yaakov added giranasha after that incident with the, so to speak, the angel. The wrestling match. V'hispalal arvis. And he davened the evening prayer. Uv mitzrayim nitztava Amram b'mitzvos yiseros. And in Egypt, Amram, that's the father of Moshe, was commanded in additional mitzvos. Ad sheba Moshe Rabbeinu, until Moshe Rabbeinu came, v'nishlama Torah al yado. And the Torah was completed through him. So here you have the Rambam's understanding of the situation, the Rambam does not maintain that the Avos kept the Torah as we know it, Taryag. They basically kept the seven, plus, that is Avram, Mila, circumcision, that became part of the people, circumcision, and Tefillah, one prayer. Just before I go further, I just wanted to connect something that I started before. It's coming back to me now. That the point of that story about the convert was to show that there's an innate attitude, a certain aloofness that Jews have and tend to look down upon a convert. So that means that every Jew should examine himself. That means that it's possible that a Jew partakes of a certain feeling of superiority. Because God gave us the Torah, because we're the chosen ones, and so on and so forth. So that is an emotion which is not based on any kind of reality. It's just an egotistic thing. It's just a base emotion. And in general, you really shouldn't look down on anybody. Even, I'm not saying it because he's a Jew. You shouldn't have that attitude towards anybody, even non-Jews. Any feeling of superiority. But certainly someone who's Jewish, there's less of a justification because he's keeping the Torah. He's part of the Jewish people. He has the same status that you have. So there's absolutely no basis whatsoever for any kind of a feeling like that. The point I wanted to make was that in this day and age, throughout history then, somebody who converted to Judaism, especially at a time when the Jews were downtrodden, the matzav of the Jews has changed now at times. I keep mentioning that, especially in a country like America. Today, there's a tremendous rate of disconversions, whether they're legitimate conversions or not, but that attitude that nobody wants to be part of the Jewish people because the Jewish people is a persecuted and hated people, that doesn't exist anymore in America. It does exist in the world. Anti-Semitism still exists, but not in America, pretty much, unless you're paranoid. So then you'll find anti-Semitism, you know, you'll always find that, but the Jews are looked up to in America. The Jews are respected as much as any other group. And a Jew could be elected president. When Lieberman ran for vice president, all the polling showed that, in fact, according to the popular vote, they did win the popular vote. It's even that question, who really, technically speaking, who won the election, whatever it is. All right, Bush, the Supreme Court, they decided he won it. But in terms of votes, in terms of popularity, there's no question the other side had more popularity. So you see that the being a Jew did not deter, was not a deterrent. So in this day and age, to convert to Judaism does not carry with it anymore that element of greatness in terms of being willing to leave your own people and join up with this despised people. Certainly not if you convert in America. However, I do think that to become a Noahide in many ways does express this type of a strength and independence and even a greatness, because the Noahide is sort of in between, separated himself from his or her own people or religion, if you want to put it that way, and has not joined another one. That is, what's your religion? What are you? So it does become more difficult. It does become more difficult. At least the convert has certain advantages. Now you're a Jew. Now you belong to the Jewish people. And so on and so forth. You can participate. The fact that theoretically you may suffer a certain type of not even a discrimination, I don't think. In certain circles, maybe they won't accord you the highest status because the yichus factor, you know, Jews are big on yichus. All right, but that's not, by and large, you belong to a people and you participate in the benefits and you have a religion. You have a religion to practice. But being a Noahide is very, very complicated. What's the religion? It's just abstract. Where are the rituals? Where is the community? Where is the structure? And so on and so forth.
I didn't learn
let's get back to the question though. If that's the case, what do you learn from this? That the Avos did not keep the Torah as we know it. It's clear from the Rambam. They didn't keep the Torah. 7 Noahide laws plus a few more. At most, what do we have? 3? Until Amram. You have circumcision, you have Tzvili, you have Meiser, you have Gid Anasha. So you have 4. The question is that in most cases, when you have the role models, the ultimate role models, they are the people who were there first, who kept this system, who fulfilled this religion. Here we have a very interesting thing, a strange thing, that those people who we regard as the ultimate role models did not keep this religion. It would seem. See from this that Judaism is not a religion in the ordinary sense. If it was a religion in the ordinary sense, this is a very, very important point, because I think most people look at Judaism as a religion in the ordinary sense. That essentially it's doing certain ritualistic activities which are mysterious, which are, so to speak, quote-unquote magical, and which have a certain type of profundity that we can't grasp, and it's based upon a certain faith that we have. It's all rooted in faith, and that by doing these ritualistic performances, we're effectuating certain results that take place on a metaphysical level, primarily for our own benefit, to ward off punishments and to secure our best interests. That's the religious mentality. However, you see from this that it's not the case, that God related to Abraham on the basis of the fact that he was living a certain way of life. The essence of Abraham and the essence of the story to leave his homeland and to go to the land of Canaan, was to establish a Derech HaChayim. It's a way of life which is based upon certain premises. And without necessarily a system, he understood the fundamentals of this way of life, the Derech HaChayim, the correct way of life. See, if you're going to say that, then you're really saying that Judaism is all rational. It's reason. Because here's an individual who pretty much, with his own reason, of course Hashem communicated with him, of course he had Nevuah, but without a system of mitzvos, was able to achieve the objective. When you talk about mitzvos, you're talking about the technical aspects of the mitzvah, and you also have to be aware of the objective, the philosophical objective of the mitzvah. And that's why you say, the bracha, Asher Kedushanu, the mitzvosav, who sanctified us with it, the commandments. That every mitzvah has the objective of perfecting you in a certain way, of effecting certain emotions, causing you to overcome certain tendencies, and communicating knowledge and ideas, which should be applied across the board to all areas of life. There are certain mitzvahs, there's no question, that means that all the mitzvahs are rational, obviously. All the mitzvahs are rational. All the mitzvahs make sense. There's no such thing as a mitzvah that does not have a reason, doesn't have a tam. Of course, we have the category of chukim, statutes, which means to say that here it contains very profound wisdom, which is not apparent at first glance, as opposed to some mitzvahs whose utility, whose benefit is pretty much apparent. At first, well, not at first glance, then as you study it and so forth, but what we're saying in the chukim is that it's kind of a different kind of wisdom which is pretty much hidden from a person, and only people on an extremely advanced level know how to penetrate to that deep wisdom. But we're not saying that there are mitzvos that are without reason. So that's the idea of the avos. There's an idea. I think it's very, very significant. It's not just that it's okay, so now we've solved the problem, that the founders and the role models are people that didn't keep our system. They did keep the system. But it's in line with the idea that even later on, when the Torah was given, and we did have people that were observing the Tarayag mitzvos, because once the Torah is given at Sinai, everything that happens after that, people are observing the Tarayag mitzvos, and the Torah still doesn't depict them. Oh, you have they came to the time to bring the Korban Pesach. You have certain cases. That the bringing of the Korban Pesach and so on. Pesach Sheni. Okay? So you see that they're doing the mitzvos. But that certainly is not the emphasis. And then when you get to the entry into the land, For example, I could show you specific cases where we know from the Torah Shebaal Peh that a certain mitzvah was kept, but it's not recorded in the Torah Shebichtav. For example, the Birkas HaMazon. Derived, the Birkas that we have today is derived from Moshe. There were four authors, Moshe, Yoshua, David, and Shlomo. The first bracha was composed by Moshe Rabbeinu, Hazanus Olam Kulo, who sustains the entire world. When did he compose that bracha? What point in history did he compose that bracha? When the man came down. But you read the story in the Torah about the man, it doesn't mention that Moshe Rabbeinu then composed the bracha of Hazan. But we know that to be true from the Masorah. And the second bracha of Nodalacha, that we give thanks and acknowledgement to Hashem for the land, was composed by Yahushua. When? When he entered the land. But it doesn't record that. And the third one was by David, the first part by David, when he conquered Yerushalayim. So a few hundred years later, obviously. About over 400 years later. And the co-author of that third bracha of Rachem is who? Who's the co-author? Shlomo. When he built the Beis HaMikdash. So there was a tefillah. Of course, they didn't pray for the restoration of the base. They had just built it. They prayed for the maintenance. The idea that the Birkas HaMazon must contain a prayer to Hashem for the maintenance of your holy city and the Beis HaMikdash, that's part of the essence of the Birkas HaMazon. It's expressed when the Beis HaMikdash is in existence, it's for the continued maintenance of it. When it was destroyed, it was for the rebuilding of it. But none of these things are recorded in the Torah. Now, I think that the idea over here is that the Torah, and I'm just suggesting this, is a theory of mine. I'm suggesting, maybe there's more than one reason, but I think that this is certainly a valid point. Does anybody? I think it's possible to say that the Torah does not want us to get identify with them because of the doing of the mitzvos, per se. There is a very, very strong emotion in people to get attached, to separate the meticulous performance of the mitzvos apart from the philosophical. And there are many, many people whose religiosity consists of being very, very rigorous with regard to the performance of the mitzvos, which is a good thing, I'm not criticizing that, but it's not seen in a context of perfection. When it comes to pursuing the perfection of the mitzvah, that's ignored. It's as though the doing of the mitzvah, that meticulousness itself, making sure everything is done right. So the performance of mitzvahs becomes an end in itself. It becomes a religious activity, a religion by itself. That's our thing. Our thing is to do mitzvahs. But there, you see, that's already a distortion. That's a distortion because when you're saying that, you're denying this whole point that it's a philosophical perfection. And you're saying that the very act of doing it itself, that's what counts. And how does it work? Well, I mean, they may not say these things, but it's sort of, on an unconscious level, you're getting reward. That is, without thinking it in conscious terms, thinking it through, it's sort of like, I do these good deeds, I get a check, so I get credit. Then I have my sins, and I got to over. It's sort of a very mechanistic, mechanical religious system. That seems to me that that's the mentality of many people. There is a certain religious mentality. That is something that one should be aware of. Doing the mitzvot is extremely important. Doing them meticulously is extremely important. But a person can get hooked up on the mere performance per se, and never go to the next step of the perfection of the personality by internalizing all of the values, all of the ideals. And that's why you do see a tremendous disparity in the world. You do see a tremendous disparity among some religious people, especially very, very religious people, between the meticulousness that they display with regard to the performance and how they act in an ethical way, how they act in business, how they treat people. You see a tremendous divide. You don't see that same kind of a perfection. It is supposed to produce a certain personality. That, I think, is what the Torah is telling us. The essence of Avraham, he kept the mitzvahs. We're not suggesting that it's not important. The danger with this kind of talk, and the reason why it's feared, is because it's sort of like this is always a tension. Well, if we're going to emphasize the ethical in Judaism, then once the people are going to start, so then, all right, so the mitzvahs aren't that important. As long as I'm a good person, as long as I'm ethical, even if I don't keep the mitzvahs that meticulously. That's dangerous. That's a dangerous thought. And the Rabbi Soloveitchik said one time, the Rav one time said, that, you know, the Gemara records that Hillel, when the convert asked him to teach him the essence of Judaism while he's standing on foot, so he says the essence is that you should you should love your neighbor as yourself. Don't do unto others. He said, don't do unto others what you would, that famous statement, what you would not want. What's disgusting to you, don't do to others. The rest is footnotes. So he said that could have had the effect of misleading a lot of people. He said that was the whole basis of the Reform movement. That, you see, the essence of Judaism is really not the performance of mitzvos, but the moral perfection. Yeah, there is a danger with that idea. That you can't negate the significance of the mitzvos. God gave us the mitzvos. And it's vitally important that we preserve them, that we keep them. That if a person has that thought... See, these are two dangerous thoughts. That one dangerous thought is that I really, all that matters is how many mitzvahs I do, and it becomes like a scoring points kind of a religious system. That's a very dangerous thought, because it prevents you from really pursuing true perfection. And as we said, the Rambam says that a Jew has to do tshuva, not just for the technical, you see, but you have to do tshuva for the mitzvahs. If there are two sections in Hilchos Tshuva. One pertains to the tshuva that a person has to do for the specific, for violation of God's system. This is God's system, and it has to be taken very, very seriously. And a person doesn't have the right to, you know, to introduce his own changes and to determine how much do I have to keep, how much I don't have to keep. This is God's system. However, there's another section of tshuva on perfection, having to do with a person's midos, that a person has to examine his midos. And these are things that do not entail necessarily violation of any specific mitzvos. Materialism, chasing after money, anger, and honor, and so on and so forth. So, there's two dangers. There's one danger in... They both have to do with the mitzvos. I guess they're two powerful emotions. There are those who seek to cling to the mitzvos and make the mitzvah the end in itself. And that's their whole identity as a religious Jew, in terms of observance. There are those who go to the other extreme and want to focus just on the objective of the mitzvah without having to be bound to the specifics, to achieve that goal through the performance of the mitzvahs. And the danger, of course, is, first of all, you can't negate the mitzvahs, but that's based upon overestimation of the self. And a certain type of a resistance to living in accordance with the divine authority. That will masquerade itself as being, I'm just an ethical person and a moral person, so it doesn't really matter what I eat, what I don't eat, etc. I'm only concerned on the good. I'm a good person. I want to be just focusing on the good. That, too, is a very big mistake. It's a very big mistake. It's based on an overestimation of the self and a desire to gratify all of one's desires, and so on. In my opinion, though, the reason for the phenomenon that the Torah is focusing on the Avos and all the other great individuals, it's presenting to you how a person lives his life. When they encounter all kinds of situations, all kinds of challenges, all kinds of difficulties, dealing with other people, you see all the stories that about Avraham and Yitzhak and Yaakov, how they dealt, how people who are fortified with this way of thinking, with this way of life, how it enables them to deal with all kinds of situations, to live the appropriate life in reality. That's really where the Torah is based. In that sense, the Avos kept the entire Torah. They kept the entire Torah. And they were on the level... They were on the level where it wasn't necessary for them to have all of these particularistic, ritualistic, because they understood the entire philosophy of the Torah and how it should be implemented in different situations. The whole life of Avram was based upon the concern for other people, for all of mankind, because they were created. But Tzalmo, once he recognized God, and once he recognized Tzalmo Elohim, so then that included all Tzalmo Elohim. And he wanted to fulfill the objective that God created Adam for. And of course, Hachnasas Orchim. And Pidyon Shvuyim, for example. The redeeming of the captives. When his nephew Lot was captured. But not only that, but you see other things. The fact that he was able to conduct war. That's something nobody wants to focus on. That he didn't just go off with 318 men and just have blind faith that God would save him. That doesn't make any sense. But these people were trained. He had a plan. He understood warfare. So he dealt with the world as it was, and he took appropriate action, the appropriate response in every situation. That's part of his perfection as well. If you read the Psukim carefully, it seems to me that one has to assume, deduce, from the way it describes that midnight raid against the mighty coalition that had taken over the whole world. And Avraham, with 318 kids, launches this raid, and he defeats them completely and takes all the booty and brings it all back. Was this a miracle? It's not depicted as a miracle. And besides, how can you rely on a miracle? You're not allowed to rely on a miracle. So if that's the case, if Avraham had no plan, he had no preparation, he had no sense of how he could succeed, he just went out and did it because he had faith in God, so is that not teaching the wrong lesson? That we should rely on miracles? However, if you go through the Psukim carefully, you will see that he had a plan. He knew what he was doing. And there's many reasons why he was able, the element of surprise, the fact they had just carried off this big victory, they were coming home with all the spoils. That was the last thing in the world they would ever expect. So they weren't even prepared. Who knows if they had sentries posted. They won a complete victory. Who else is out there? There's no other army out there. So it shows you that with a plan, with the element of fighting at night, attacking at night, with dividing up, he divided up his men. He was able to pull off, and it was a quick raid. And to achieve a lightning victory type of thing. In my opinion, Avraham had trained his men, because you're living in a dangerous world, and there's an obligation of self-defense. Now, once he got into it, he used his brilliant mind, and he was able to work out brilliant tactics when the situation called for it. So that's another thing that you learn from studying the Avos. Look at all the things you can learn about how a person should live his life. Yet you see many people today, among the religious communities, for one reason or another, don't have that idea. The idea that we have to defend ourselves, that it's a mitzvah to train and to fight. And there is a segment in Israel that does not believe in serving in the army. And they have this idea that they study Torah, that their Torah protects the land, even though that's contrary to what we find in the Torah. That you're supposed to study Torah. There's no question about it. And the higher the level that we're on, the closer we are to God. But we're not on a higher level than Avraham. In spite of that, if there's a situation of practical danger, you have to prepare for it. You can't sit back and rely on God, no matter how close you are to God. We never find that. Yaakov Avinu took concrete action, concrete steps to prepare for his encounter with Esau, whatever he could do. See, there seems to be an idea that's lost. There seems to be an idea of faith. That idea that in Yahadus, one has to have Emunah, of course, one has to have faith. But it cannot supplant the responsibility, the obligation of a person to do everything that's in his power and to act with the greatest wisdom. And then if he merits, then God is with him and God will help him to bring his endeavors to success. That's the appropriate idea of emunah, of faith. With regard to the Avos, the Torah does record things that they did that could have been wrong. We don't maintain that there's such a thing as a perfect human being. We maintain, Rabbi Hirsch makes this point in his Chumash, the Ramban criticized Avraham for leaving the land. That's a very controversial issue. Virtually all of the other commentators disagree, and they said that even though he was supposed to live in the land, but that only illustrates the point. You can't rely on miracles. So when there was a famine, We don't know the particulars, but apparently he felt that he couldn't get by any longer and he had to leave the land intending to come back. The Ramban criticizes him. Rabbi Hirsch comes to the defense of Avraham and he says, but before he does so, he says, I'm not doing this because I have a need to portray Avraham as being someone who could never make a mistake, because we don't have such a phenomenon. Judaism doesn't have anything, concept that this is the person that you should follow. This person is perfect. That the deification of man, as Christianity has. We don't have such a thing, and therefore, they're all human beings, and even Moshe Rabbeinu is capable of sin, of chet. So he said, if that's the case, I'd have no problem. That's not preventing me from going along with the Ramban. But nevertheless, I have other reasons why I think that, he shows why he doesn't agree. He thinks that Avraham was perfectly legitimate in what he did. So you will find the Ramban is critical of the Avos in their treatment of Hagar, for example. And Chazal are critical of Yaakov in terms of the situation of being responsible for what happened to Yosef. He pays a heavy price. He suffers as a result of it. What's great about the Torah is that it's showing you, it's letting you enter into their lives, how they live their lives and the mistakes that they made. And we can learn from the mistakes as well. The mistakes of Yaakov, the mistakes of Yosef. And Yosef's behavior also, he had to overcome that. He went on to greatness. And the same thing with the brothers. That's the greatness of the Torah, that we're being able to see these role models. We shouldn't think, we shouldn't have the idea that they're saints and that they always do the right thing. And they can never do the wrong thing. No, to the contrary, one of the great things about the Torah, especially you see by David HaMelech, how they deal with failure. Everybody is going to sin. There's no such thing. People, in my opinion, are very, very devastated by the inability to do tshuva. The inability to do tshuva because, by and large, people want to do the right thing. But they feel conflicts. And when they fail, there's too much guilt involved. And that's it. I sinned. I'm worthless. And that whole idea that because I've sinned, I'm worthless, as opposed, and that cripples people. I've seen people being crippled by that. Now, once you have that thought, A, you don't do tshuva, and B, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's it. You just sort of give up on yourself. And you don't want to even get back into, you stay away from Judaism because you're afraid that if I get into it again, and then I'm going to have a, do a mistake and do an aver, I'm going to feel guilty again. So let me just stay away from the whole thing. Keep my distance. One of the great things that we discover in studying certain personalities, I particularly associate this with David, is that even though people are capable of committing averos and even serious averos, serious sins, the true greatness, the hidden greatness of many of these characters is how they respond to an avera. And that they do tshuva, courageously doing tshuva. But a lot of times a person does tshuva and he backs off from life. That's a big response to tshuva. That is, some people don't do tshuva. Okay. Some people do tshuva, but they're not the same afterwards. They're devastated by the downfall, by the experience. And they're afraid. They lose their self-esteem. They feel that they're, because they were operating with a certain kind of an image of the tzaddik, and the tzaddik is a person that could never do such and such. I did such and such. So that's it. I'm not a tzaddik. I can't be a tzaddik anymore. And they may keep the system, but they just don't have that same ability to bounce back. Who am I? They berate themselves. Who am I to... If it's a teacher, let's say. Let's say it's a rabbi. A rabbi could sin too. So up until that point, he had a certain gusto and he was leading people and rebuking people and telling people, then he fell into some trap and he sinned. So he may do tshuva, but he may feel, I better resign and retire. Who am I? Who am I? You see, David HaMelech remained the king. That's a tremendous thing. Even though he committed a serious avera, and he was rebuked by the prophet, so you might say, okay, he's rebuked, do tshuva, and that's it. No. He still retained his rationality. He still retained his capability of living and doing what had to be done. He wasn't crushed by sin. That is a tremendously important message, not to be crushed by sin. Not to just go on and say, the heck with it, I'm doing my thing. That's what's... And many people take that path. See, people don't want to confront sin. They do not want to confront sin, especially in this day and age when it's a hedonistic existence. So people, there's an interference. I want to feel good about myself. So just following my emotions in life makes me feel good about myself, that's all. So they don't want to deal with the idea of sin. And other people who deal with the idea of sin have a very allergic reaction. That they are crushed by it. When they finally are forced to confront it, see, there's two things when you confront it. You could say, I'm acknowledging it, now what should I do about it? You could look at it like a disease. If you have a disease and there's a treatment, you get the treatment and you move on. You, just because I got that disease, am I going to be devastated? That means I'm an inferior person? No. The important thing to do is when you notice a disease, to deal with it rationally. So you search out the doctor, whatever the thing, he tells you what you have to do, you take the cure, this and that, a few months' time, you're back to yourself. You go back to yourself with the same vigor. You don't lose your vigor in life. But a lot of people can't do that after sin. Even if they should confront it, they allow themselves to be defeated by it. And that is a very big problem of sin. It's extremely important that a person react to these things in the intelligent way. And that's something I think that comes through in the Avos. That's something that comes through, that you shouldn't think because you've sinned that now you're disqualified and you're a diminished person. There's a process. You have to do tshuva. You should honestly face it. You should honestly do the tshuva. But once you've done the tshuva, you should not let it cripple you because you're giving up your life. Life goes on and you continue with the same energy. You incorporate the new wisdom that you've gotten about yourself. But to give up on life, and I do think a lot of people do that, because they're devastated by a certain guilt that comes into the picture with religion. Unfortunately, I think the Jews have been influenced by the Gentiles in terms of the guilt factor.